Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Kurt Nikisch. Change is hard. Digital transformation is harder. Moving a company's technology, people, and products into the future, that often fails. A recent survey found that less than one-third of attempted transformations succeed at improving a company's performance and sustaining growth. On the show today, we're talking to a CEO who is successfully leading her firm's shift to digital. Nancy McKinstry is the chair and CEO of Wolters Kluwer. The Dutch multinational began as a publishing house way back in the 1830s and has grown into a global information services company. When McKinstry became CEO in 2003, the company earned just 31% of its revenue from digital products. Today, it's 91%. The company's stock price has doubled over the last 3 years. And that performance is a big reason why McKinstry is ranked as the top woman on HBR's list of the 100 best performing CEOs of 2019. And she joins me now. Nancy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You started your career in management consulting. Later, you had a number of roles at Wolters Kluwer. Right. And eventually ran the North American business. Did you always have ambitions to lead a big company from the top?
No, I did not. My journey was, I originally started out believing I wanted to go into the Foreign Service when I was in university, and then just by happenstance took an economics class and just found it fascinating. So I sort of switched from, you know, a desire to serve the, you know, in public service to business.
Yeah.
So I went to Columbia Business School. Out of there, I went to Booz Allen in Hamilton, a consulting firm in New York. And at that time, this would have been sort of mid to late 80s, early 90s. It was a really fascinating time to be in consulting because it was this sort of convergence between media, technology, and telco, things like the internet and voice over IP and those kinds of things. So I got to do a lot of really interesting work. You work on really complex problems. And so what that taught me was, first of all, to be very data-driven, because often, whether it was going out and talking to customers or talking to competitors or actually doing analysis with numbers, but it was the data that ultimately would largely drive you towards the solution. So it taught me to be very data-driven, and it also taught me to not be afraid of problems, right? Because what you learn there is every problem can be uncoupled and most problems have solutions, right? And if you just can kind of really peel back the layers and get to the root causes, you can solve things.
Yeah. What other soft skills did you learn during that time that you're thanking yourself for now?
Yeah, a lot around communications. You know, I still would say both my liberal arts degree before I went to my MBA plus in consulting taught me to be a very strong writer, which I believe is still an incredibly important skill in business, and also how to communicate a strategy in a way that people will understand and in a way that can motivate people to respond. But at the time I started out, you know, in university, you know, this notion of what is a, I didn't even know what a CEO did. So it was never sort of this aspiration until, you know, later in my career.
You didn't set out to be one, but when did you know that you did want to be one?
Well, at the time that I became the CEO, you know, I was running the largest business unit and the company was really behind. You know, the company was not doing particularly well financially, and we were behind in terms of coming to terms with the fact the internet was going to have a profound impact on the business. So I was very concerned about the company, and I really wanted us to move forward in a certain way. And so when succession became clear, you know, I was able to articulate, here's what I would do with the business. And I actually credit our board because I was the first non-Dutch CEO in the history of the company. And that took a great deal of courage, I think, for them to say, okay, we're going to give this individual a chance. And in addition, I was a female, but it was really being not, you know, non-Dutch that became critical. And so at that moment, I was both honored to be given the opportunity to lead the company.
What a legacy,
but,
right?
But also feeling a really deep sense of responsibility that we had to move quickly and we had to do a certain set of, you know, strategic things or the company might not survive.
You're an American.
Yes.
Do you think that made a difference?
Yeah. So I don't think that the nationality per se had importance, but I do think what it allowed me to do is I was both an insider, right? Because I'd been running North America, so I really did understand the business and knew what we needed to do. But because I was different, I was not Dutch, and I was a female, I could also do things very differently. I had the best of both worlds in the sense I was an insider, but an outsider, right? And I moved with my family to the Netherlands, and I was able to make change in a way that I think it would have been very difficult for perhaps a male Dutch person to make the same level of change at the same pace.
It is an amazing journey, right? Yeah. You take over in 2003. That's a very early time in the digital economy, relatively. Yeah. Get through the Great Recession, which hit publishers especially hard.
Right.
And you actually made that transition, and you're seeing great growth from that in recent years. What do you credit that to?
A couple things. It is truly about innovation, right? It is because if you look now at what we do, right? So I often describe this, which I think is, again, goes back to sort of my interest in economics, is if you think about the first, you know, kind of wave of transformation going from print to digital. So just think about picking up all this content and putting it available online. That first wave, it didn't create any bigger profit pools. In fact, I would argue that the profit pools shrunk, right? Because you had to invest in two kinds of formats, right? And so that was really heavy work, right? And I credit every employee at Wolters Kluwer that people just worked really hard to make that happen. Now, if you look at the next transformation that we've been on, this journey is around these expert solutions. And that's where, again, we bring content or domain expertise together with technology, we develop a tool and we deliver it to our customers, and the tool gives them enormous value, whether it's a productivity or insights or better outcomes, really demonstrable results that the customer can see.
Right.
That transformation, and now we're about 50%
from information
to really
services.
Solutions, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
software, right? So this transformation, about 50% of our revenues now come from these expert solutions. That transformation is enlarging the profit pools. So what's so exciting for me as the CEO, and certainly the excitement among our employees, is that this next wave of transformation is really rewarding because we're adding so much more value to our customers. And at the same time, we can see that the profit pools will increase. Therefore, we'll have more investment, you know, to drive even further growth. So that first wave was critical because we wouldn't be where we are today without it, but it was a lot of heavy lifting to now get into the second wave. And it's rewarding, I think, for everyone in the organization to now see the kind of fruits of that labor of effort that was required in the early, you know, kind of transformational period.
Yeah. What was hard about that journey? I mean, it sounds very successful looking back on it, right?
Yeah.
And you talked about having a vision for it.
Right.
There must have been some dark days in there too.
Yes. And I would say that what was hard about it is that print lasted a really long time. I mean, today we still have some of our divisions that are only 65% digital. And in the beginning of this transformation, if you had interviewed me back in 2003, I would have said it was generational, that when the next generation of doctors or partners came into being, that all of the print would disappear. Not the case. So what was difficult is beginning to recognize that how our customers work is around a use case. So what are they trying to accomplish? And in some cases, still today, you'll see still physicians today and young physicians with their white coats on, and she or he will take out the book and look something up. The customer has decided there's certain situations where print is still an effective way to do work. Now, of course, that's not the future of Wolters Kluwer or even the future of these professions. But I think back to the hard part is that the length of time it's taken to migrate customers from, you know, analog to digital was much longer than I think we expected. So as a result of that, if you look at the tipping point, you know, we had to get to about 75% digital before the numbers really started to move. Hmm. So if you're a shareholder or you're an employee, you know, there were years in there where you're thinking, okay, because you had this weight of print shrinking, you know, when was that going to become not so material?
Right.
So today it's not material, and therefore you see that all the good digital growth that we've had for years is really coming through in the financial results. We were managing these very long migration cycles. And what's interesting now is that we're seeing the same thing with the migration to SaaS. So, you know, we started with these workflow tools.
Software as a service. Right,
exactly. Yeah. So a quick example, we are one of the largest providers of tax compliance software. So if you use an accountant to do your tax returns, I'm pretty sure he's using our product to do that, right? And we've been in that business for many, many years. And we're migrating customers, right? Customers are recognizing the value of this SaaS offering and they're moving over. But we anticipate it will take probably 15 years to move people over in a major way. So these cycles are quite
Which is about
long.
As long as you've been CEO.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what is the implication of all of this? It's twofold. One is that you as a leader have to make sure you're investing in both formats or both opportunities because you still have a big base of on-premise customers. You have to keep those products healthy and at the same time you have to migrate. So you have to be very clear as you think through your capital allocation. We've got these two platforms for a while. That's one. Second implication is that you have to make sure that you help the customer on that journey. And the third thing we found, which I find quite interesting, is that when we're first to market with next generation products, we can gain market share. And again, an example is in the tax market. We've been in the market pretty much by ourselves with a SaaS solution, and we've gained a lot of new customers. So part of our program around innovation is to be where we can be first to market with next generation solutions.
How much of that growth strategy involves international growth and new markets?
Yeah, so today about 60% of our revenues come out of North America and the rest, you know, about 30% or so in Europe, and then the rest of the world is still a relatively small part. So we are investing in places, and we have for years, in China, India, Brazil, you know, economies that, you know,
we're gonna
are growing faster.
We're going to have more doctors
faster.
And lawyers,
yes,
and accountants.
Exactly, but yeah. The absolute markets are still pretty small.
Okay.
And I tell this story, which again is a good reminder for our organization, is when we started in China, which is now about 35 years ago, there were no lawyers in China at that time. Now there's about 250,000 lawyers. So compare that to the U.S. where there's over 2 million. So these markets, just on an absolute basis, are for what we do is still relatively small. So the goal, and this is again back to what's so important as a CEO, is that you have to be able to have a perspective and a vision 50 years out or 25 years out, something longer than the near term, because the monies we've been investing in China all these 35 years, it's some long-term future. It's not moving our results in the current year.
Right.
So you have to be able to, again, have that patience around investing over the long term. Even today, I mean, again, what's interesting is we've taken this journey. If you look today at these workflow solutions, it takes a couple of years to build them in terms of fully featured, but then it might take 5 to 7 years to build the market. So if you look at 2019, our best-selling products were started being built 12 years ago. So as an investor, again, if you think about us allocating capital, right, what do you need to do? You need to be sure that you're investing enough to keep your current products healthy. And then you have to bring out a series of new products and make sure that the funnel of new products is, again, healthy.
Managers, increase your knowledge, confidence, and impact with the Financial Intelligence Set. It will enable you to mine every bit of meaning from the financial reports that cross your desk, to employ financial techniques that can multiply your effectiveness, and to foresee business opportunities that remain invisible to others. And if you're not a numbers person, this collection is the perfect way to learn what you've always needed to know. Don't miss this chance to do it. Visit hbr.org/store/collections to buy this valuable set. Again, visit hbr.org/store/collections to buy the Financial Intelligence Set.
Let me ask you about another transformation.
Yeah.
During your tenure, the number of women in senior leadership at Wolters Kluwer rose pretty dramatically.
Yes.
You also mentioned that, you know, you were the first woman CEO of the company, which was maybe not as important as being the first non-Dutch
That's
CEO.
Right.
But talk about that transformation.
Yeah. So first I would say I've become a strong proponent of diversity, not just gender diversity, but nationality diversity, because what I have seen firsthand is our most diverse teams are the most creative, they are the most innovative, and they deliver the best results. So it is, if you're a leader of a company, particularly a public company, and you want good results, why wouldn't you as a business leader want to harness as much diversity as you can? So that was one. Second is, in terms of how we got there, I would say in the beginning, it was very organic. You know, we were on this journey. We were having to move quickly. It was very difficult, right, to get the ship moving in the right direction. So we just started to hire, you know, a lot of people of all different nationalities, gender, diversity started to occur then. We promoted a lot of people because we needed their talents. And we started by just that activity to recognize, wow, we were getting more diversity. And lo and behold, again, the more diverse teams were creating the best results. So it went from sort of this organic activity to then really managing diversity. And so what did that include? That it has included really focusing on the middle management pipeline. And again, not just gender diversity, but nationality diversity. And so I believe that in order to get diversity at the top, you have to start at middle management. Because at the end of the day, as a CEO, you have to select the best people for the job, right? And you do that because you want to get the best results. And so we started to run certain programs and give people certain experiences at middle management that would then allow us to have diversity at the top. So today, you know, we have four divisions, which are about equal in size in terms of revenue, and three out of the four are run by females. That didn't just happen by accident, right? That happens by giving people experience at sort of that middle management and above level that allows them to be even in the running for those top roles.
Yeah, it's a process again.
It's a process.
Another setting expectations. And
yeah, and it takes time, yeah. Right? It's a process, it takes time, but it also takes a strong commitment. And now what you would see, I mean, it's quite interesting, is if you go to any meeting at Wolters Kluwer and you look, I mean, what you would see is people of all nationalities, gender, you know, lots of females represented in the audience. It's a very diverse group. So it's very rare to walk into a room where everybody looks like each other.
So that's one way it's changed the company. How else do you think it's changed the company as far as performance goes?
I would say again that our growth has improved. You know, it's not a one-for-one correlation, but certainly as we've become more diverse, the organic growth of the business has improved, and that's coming again from driving innovation throughout the business. Mm-hmm. I would also say it's a bit of a flywheel, if you know that concept of a flywheel, meaning that what you see is that people both stay with us and join us because they see the diversity.
Right.
So it ends up being self-perpetuating, right? Because people say, wow, if I'm Italian or I'm a female, I can get to a certain level at Wolters Kluwer that maybe if I go to one of our competitors might not.
I'm gonna have to break a barrier.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And so it ends up being this self-propelling kind of, you know, activity.
Yeah. France, I know, legislated this, right? They have quotas for women in senior positions.
More at the board level. So some of the countries, you know, the Netherlands is also now, it's not necessarily a law, but it's a best practice. They want 30% representation at the board level.
Do you think goals like that work?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've completely changed my point of view on this subject. I used to believe up until maybe a couple of years ago that I didn't believe in quotas, and I believed it was all going to be a meritocracy and it would change and et cetera.
Right.
But now—
Smart companies will just do it anyway.
Yeah, because it makes sense from a business performance perspective. But now I really actually do believe it makes sense to set quotas in certain ways, certainly at the board level, maybe even having companies, maybe not a quota, but making companies report on how diverse they are at the top of their organization is very important, because the changes happen too slowly. And what you hear from executives is, oh, there's not enough talented, you know,
wish I could.
Talented women, yeah. Or not enough African Americans. And it's just not true. there is plenty of talent out there, right? It's just, can you harness the talent and then develop it? Because again, you don't get to the top without going through the middle. And what you have seen is in the places where quotas have been set, it's making a difference.
Yeah.
So I wish we didn't have to get there, but I honestly think we're at a point where we've got to have some kind of catalyst that starts to propel more diversity.
What?
Because our customers are diverse. What's really interesting from my perspective is when your customers come to visit you, and if they're looking out at who, you know, whoever they're interacting with, and it's just, again, a group that looks like each other, it has an impact. And sometimes they would comment on that, you know, if I think back to when we weren't so diverse. And so diversity has a direct impact, I believe, on innovation and business performance. And I also believe it has a real impact on customer relationships.
You've talked about this now at the company or organizational level. What advice do you have for an individual who is trying to break a barrier like you did? What advice do you have for a woman who aspires to be at the CEO position someday?
Yeah, I've given this a lot of thought, obviously, because I do mentor individuals and I do get asked this question. I would say it's really three things. First, you have to deliver results, right? Nobody gets promoted unless they deliver results. So focus on that is your first job. Second is, you know, ensure that you are very skilled at setting priorities, developing strategies, and communicating. So those are, again, to get to the top, you have to be able to articulate a vision. You have to motivate people to go down that track with you and really, you know, hold them accountable. And then finally, figure out a way to build support, you know, whether that's support within your family unit to help you along that journey, because getting to the top requires a lot of sacrifice, or whether it's support within your team and your organization to help you get to the next level. And I would particularly, I always say to women that ask my advice, take some risks. You know, I have had this experience a couple of times where I'm approaching a female leader and I want them to take on a new assignment. Maybe it's a turnaround, so a tough situation. And I've had female leaders say, oh, I'm not ready for that. I've never had a male leader tell me they weren't ready for the job. And so I will say to them, you are ready. You need to take this job and I'm going to help you. And finally, the last thing I would say, which I think is true for anybody in business, regardless of gender, is surround yourself with the best people you can find.
I want to ask another piece of advice from you, and that is for CEOs, regardless of gender, who are leading a digital transformation or a company through an innovative process to renew itself. What's the biggest misunderstanding about leading one of those that you want to clear up?
Yeah, I would say first and foremost, really engage with your customers, because I think sometimes you can go down these transformations and you might expect your customers to be doing certain things or adopting things in a way that is not going to be the case. So you have to stay really close to your customer during the journey to make sure that you're not, you know, way too far out in front, or you're not investing in things that maybe aren't going to pay off. So that close proximity to customer is very critical. And I think the other thing, particularly again in a B2B space, is recognize it can take some time. And that, I think, was the surprise in many ways, I think not just for us, but for anybody in the publishing arena, was people just thought print would disappear. And it took a lot longer for that digital transformation to happen. Even though digital was growing well, it was the tipping point took many, many more years than I think most people expected. So you have to really, you know, begin to understand that some of these things take some time. And then the final thing is to have the strength and the courage to keep the investment going. There's pressure on, okay, show us the results. You've made all these investments. When are they going to pay off? And you really have to have, you know, kind of the strength of your own conviction and your belief in the strategy to keep investing.
Nancy, it's a really interesting business, fascinating transformation, and it was great to hear about your own journey there at the top. Thanks for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you very much, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
That's Nancy McKinstry, the CEO and chair of Wolters Kluwer. She is the top woman on HBR's list of the 100 best performing CEOs of the year. You can find that list in the November-December 2019 issue of Harvard Business Review and at hbr.org. This episode was produced by Mary Dew and Ann Sani. We get technical help from Rob Eckhart. Adam Buchholz is our audio product manager. Thanks for listening to the HBR IdeaCast. I'm Kurt Nikisch.